This is Tuesday night, so we're live from the Downtown Activity Center. Welcome, Warren Bell.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you for doing this, Warren. I'd say that your enlightening explanations give us tonight something to think about. Let's talk on our first subject. So I've got three topics tonight, basically. One is community radio. The other is Mary Jane, marijuana, cannabis. And the third one is the TI, the Therapeutics Initiative, which relates to marijuana, I think, in some ways. Anyway, let's start with community radio. Let's talk community radio. Why do you think, Warren Bell, CKVS 93.7, is important to Salmon Arm and the Shuswap?
Well, Steve, I think community radio in general plays a unique role in any community because of two reasons. One, that it is independent of any particular financial obligations or advertising obligations to any of its sponsors or supporters. In other words, it can say the things that are difficult to be said on other commercial radio stations, and increasingly, I fear, may be difficult to say on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC Radio, because there's some sense that political control of that particular broadcasting system may increase in the future. But at a community level, community radio stations can talk about issues in the community as well. They can talk about things that interest people in this community, not imported from outside. But, of course, it can also bring in ideas from the outside that maybe don't get talked about a lot. One example in this station, CKVS, is our development of First Nations programming, which is unique in this area. It's helped along by a generous grant that we received. But it's going to allow voices from the First Nations community to speak on the radio at length about some of the issues that are really important from their perspective. And I think they will be able to tell us things that we normally wouldn't hear on radio. And I think that's the kind of thing that community radio stations do better than
commercial stations
or public stations.
Yeah, rather interesting. I've heard some of the short clips that the First Nations have produced, and they're really interesting. It's good stuff, and it warms my heart to see that kind of thing happening.
Absolutely.
That it's coming to fruition, things that we hoped for. You know, one of the other points that I heard on CBC actually was that I want to ask you about is filling the void of newspapers that seem to be having a bit of a difficult time these days, especially dailies.
Yeah, a lot of newspapers are finding the internet is overwhelming competition. And anybody can do this, they can go to Mr. Google and type in just about anything you want to know about, contemporary or from the vast repository of human experience, and come up with an answer almost instantaneously. And when you can do that online and when you want to and about exactly what you want to know, it means that a paper that's delivered that contains a lot of material that may be irrelevant to you, that covers subjects that you're either unaware of or not particularly interested in, and inevitably has a fair amount of advertising as well. Many newspapers do that. It really kind of makes the draw of digital information pretty powerful. And a lot of newspapers, of course, are going to the internet, and on the internet, that's where a station like ours can also be present.
And we are.
And we are present.
And you know, I got to point that out. I didn't have it in my notes, but we are online. You just go to voiceofthesheshwab.ca and click on Listen Live, and you can get us anywhere in the world.
Absolutely. And in fact, people are getting it in unusual places. I believe we've had reports of people listening to us in faraway places from Salmon Arm and hearing exactly the same sound quality as they can hear if they were right in town.
Yeah, and you know, I didn't get an answer back from my daughter in Squamish, but I gave her the information. And si vous êtes là ce soir, Anne, bonsoir, et bonsoir à Carson, et à Gracie, et Kent. I just wanted to say that to my, you know, I get that opportunity.
You can do that on community radio station, Steve.
You can do
Steve.
That on community radio, and we're online. I'm sorry I cut you off, though. You were talking about newspapers and how they're going digital and
Yeah, and I think there's actually a revolution in telecommunications and in communications in general. And in that mix, a community radio station reports the voices of those who live here, telling their own stories or describing their own activities, and also portrays events that take place. For example, our very first broadcast on this station was the Silverbacks playing live in Salmon Arm, which hasn't been heard for a very long time. It was on the commercial station for a while, but it isn't there anymore. And we're very, very happy to be working with the Silverbacks. And it's an event. The Silverbacks games are more than just sporting events. They're also social events. And going to a game, you see your old friends, and you have little chin wag in the stands, and buy some refreshments, and generally kind of socialize. And
I can relate to that. Yeah.
And that's an excellent thing. It's not all, you know, sports focused. It's also community focused as well.
Exactly. And I, at this point, I have to mention our up and coming young broadcaster, Dylan Dodge, who has his own program on Thursdays now at 5 o'clock. I'll be mentioning it again, but for Thursdays sure. at 5 o'clock, Silverback Attack. And I've listened to his program, and
he's
He's delightful. Yeah, he's very interesting. He's got lots of stats, interviews.
Absolutely. And that opportunity is the sort of thing that we can foster at this station. We can have young broadcasters. We can have first-time broadcasters. We can have people who have always wanted to do a radio show but never had an opportunity to do so. And if they train in a community radio station like this, they can go on to careers in broadcasting in a broader field, having learned their chops, as it were, in a station like this. So there are many, many opportunities that this station provides.
Yeah, and I think that may happen with Dylan, because I know he wants to go to, I think it's SAIT. No, he doesn't. He's not going to SAIT. He's going to one of the universities in Calgary next year, I believe.
And we'll be able to give him an excellent recommendation.
Oh, we will. We will. In fact, I'm going to be trying
graduate.
To tune into their their campus radio station to hear him live. Yeah, to hear him there. So one of the things, though, that it's not a downside, but it's something that makes our job here as volunteers a little more difficult, and that is we do require revenue.
Yes,
and,
indeed.
You know, we need sponsorships and memberships and donations and fundraising. And it makes for, you know, you're sometimes feel a little bit insecure.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable that, especially we're only a startup. We've just passed our first anniversary on December the 10th. So we're 13 months old, barely. And as a result, we're still establishing a profile in the community. We're building up our local programming. Initially, our station was entirely music recorded and played at random for 24 hours. And now we're delighted to have many, many hours of local community programming, locally produced music, local talk shows like your show, Steve. And it's starting to come together. But all the way along the line, we're going to require support from within the community. We've had some generous grants from various sources.
From SASCU and, yep. and the CSRD.
Absolutely, and it's really made a big difference.
And the city. Yeah.
And the city. And so we're proud that the city and SASCU and other organizations have recognized that we have a valuable role in the community, and we hope to expand that profile, engage in active fundraising, maybe have some events in the community for the purpose of fundraising, which we hope will help to put this the station on a more constant and secure footing over time.
Yeah, as our base increases, the base of people, the volunteers that come here, I think our support increases.
Absolutely.
From within the community, because they each one of those people, those volunteers, you're right, there's a really nice mix of programs already.
That's right.
You know,
and I'm finding more and more when I talk to people in the community that they'll say, "Oh, I was listening to the station the other day, and I heard something, or I heard this piece of music, or I heard some commentary that was interesting to me," which is, as I said, happening more often now, indicating that our readership, or our listenership rather, is increasing at a steady rate.
Yeah. Just one thing, I know this is not a local program, but it's something that we can do, and that is for those people who are interested in current affairs and then they should possibly listen weekdays at 10 o'clock to this station, because we have Democracy Now.
Yes, indeed.
And that is a very high quality, good, it comes from, I think it's National Public Radio in the United States.
Indeed. It's a landmark program that has established itself as a source, an unvarnished and accurate source of information that doesn't make its way into the mainstream media. And that is the kind of stuff that we can program here. But this particular show has been going on for many years. it explores subjects that are sometimes quite unpopular for people who embrace the status quo, but things like political stories that are about subjects that governments don't want everybody to hear about are often portrayed in that particular program. I've listened to it a number of times, and I think it's a very high-quality show.
Very good, yeah. Now to the subject at hand. Warren, I was just reading, and we've got it in front of us here, a book called Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? I got it from the library. So tell me how we got to this. I know it's give me the condensed version of how did marijuana become so demonized?
Well, it's one of those fascinating stories of the 20th century that historians down the road are going to scratch their heads at, or maybe they won't, because maybe they'll say this is the way humans do things backwards and around the corner. The name marijuana is actually marijuana is a Mexican term, Mexican-Spanish term. And it was never used to describe what we call cannabis or pot or anything that the older names, or hemp. The name that was used for what we call marijuana was pretty much hemp throughout most of the history in the English language. The reason it became marijuana was because in the early 1930s, William Randolph Hearst, who was the famous editor of the Los Angeles Times, and Henri DuPont, who is the founder of DuPont Industries, which is a chemical company, together saw trouble looming on the horizon in the form of a new machine that was going to make the harvesting of hemp and the separation of hemp into the fiber, which is wonderful stuff. It's 4 inches long. Hemp fiber is 4 inches long. The fiber from cellulose from trees is about 3/4 inch long. So it's incredibly valuable and makes very durable cloth and paper. Anyway, they were upset because this new machine was coming along that would make the harvesting of hemp way more efficient. And there was a cover of Popular Mechanics in the early 30s, and the cover title was The Billion Dollar Industry. Now, wow. We talk about billions of dollars in the late 20th and early 21st century as if it was nothing. But in the 1930s, $1 billion was worth about 10 times as much as we now have it now. So they saw a problem, and they combined their efforts, and William Randolph Hearst had newspapers all over the United States, and he started to publish negative things eventually about marijuana. But the first thing he did, he had a cousin who worked for the Department of the Interior, and they established a very ingenious program for getting hemp off the market. And it was very simple. They simply said if it crosses state boundaries to go from one state to another, there's a 100% surcharge or excise tax that's added to the price of the hemp. So if it's crossing the borders at $100 a pound or a ton, whatever the unit of measurement, by the time it crosses that border, it's going to cost $200 a ton. And if it crosses another border, it's going to be $400 a ton.
How did they get that passed? They went to Congress?
Well, he had a cousin in the Department of the Interior. And, you know, when you have a good guy up in high places, you can get things done. Subsequently, another blow came along in the form of the Mexican government, which expropriated a large part of William Randolph Hearst's forest that he was going to use for harvesting to make paper. And he was a powerful figure who didn't take slights from...
Okay, the forest was in Mexico.
Well, on the border between Mexico, and there were a lot of... But they had an opportunity to do it, and they did it. They expropriated the land, and he was very annoyed at that. So he went on a bit of a rampage, and that's when the term marijuana was adopted from this Mexican slang repository, and suddenly what had been hemp, which was making cloth and making paper, suddenly became this drug-drenched plant that induced what eventually got called reefer madness. In other words, if you smoked a joint, which was called a reefer, you would go crazy, and what you'd do was become a sexual maniac. And a movie was made called Reefer Madness with the help and support of William Randolph Hearst. which portrayed Mexicans. The Mexican was the guy who did the dirty deed and then, of course, felt totally, totally guilty in the movie and apologized profusely to this young woman he had ravished, saying it was the marijuana that made me do it.
Oh, my God.
And that story was spread, because Hearst had newspapers everywhere, was spread far and wide, and it resulted in this increase in repugnance towards cannabis. And eventually there were laws passed in the states which banned its use and made it an illegal substance. And that's been what's gone on until recently, when over the last 15 years, first there was an interest in reusing and starting to use hemp again for fiber.
Yeah, that's...
Because you can actually breed cannabis that has no active compounds in it.
What is it, THC?
Tetrahydrocannabinol is only one of them. There's probably about 8 or 9 different compounds in 2 fundamental classes. One class called cannabinoids, and another class called terpenoids. Now, people don't know much about the terpenoids, but let me tell you, the odor of cannabis comes from the terpenoids. Oh. So they actually know about terpenoids without even knowing the name. But cannabinoids, there's at least 4 or 5 of them that are quite separate chemically, produced by the plant, all produced apparently by the female plant. And in fact, I hate to say it, it's kind of like spiders. You know, say the female spider eats the male spider. Well, the cannabis plant has a female version that produces all of the chemicals, and the male version, which when present, discourages the production of these other chemicals. So people who grow cannabis run madly around. If they see a male plant, they slaughter it on the spot because it's going to ruin the crop, apparently. Yeah, so that's just a little insight.
Well, no, that's that was what I asked about, the history and what happened. How did we get here?
Yeah.
But we could go on and on. I got a question, though, that concerns the toxicity of either alcohol or, because that's the title of this book, it's really interesting. I'm only about halfway through, but they go into great detail. What do you think is more, with respect to intoxication, which is worse, alcohol or marijuana?
Well, let's talk about it from the point of view of safety, because I think that's the fundamental issue that I think is of some significance here. Alcohol, along with many drugs that we use as sedatives, things like Valium, things like Ativan, things like Cirax, which belong to a family called the benzodiazepines, and other drugs that sedate people, and there's many other ones, all do so because they affect a part of the brain called the brain stem. Now, the brain stem, some people call it the lizard brain. It's the part of the brain that controls vegetative and functions, things like whether you're awake or in a coma, whether you are hungry, whether you want to breathe. All of these functions are controlled in the brainstem. Cannabis, it turns out, has no effect on the brainstem, where alcohol and the other sedating drugs and many other substances do affect the brainstem. So, as I pointed out to people on occasion, you could smoke 100 joints in a row and you'd probably feel pretty weird and probably not very well, but you couldn't kill yourself if you wanted to. So for all of those, please don't ever think of it.
No, anyway. Don't try this at home, obviously. But that's, I think that's the premise of this book.
It's a pretty useful fundamental premise to consider, because my profession operates under the main dictum in Latin, it's primum non nocere, which translated means, in the first place, do no harm.
Yeah.
Well, if you're going to employ any kind of remedy, whether it's a drug or a surgical intervention, or any other kind of intervention, the less harm you do, the better. Efficacy or effectiveness is also really important, but if you don't do harm in the first place, you're already a light year ahead of somebody or some intervention that does do harm.
Yeah. We have to have a program at some point, and I noticed that there's a lady that has medical marijuana, has sent me an email, and Diana, and I would like to get her on, and we could talk about some of the medical uses of marijuana.
Yes. There's been a fixation with tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC. And it's unfortunate, because this is one of the more so-called psychoactive compounds in cannabis. It's one that affects the mind more than some of the other compounds. But listeners may have heard about what's going on in Colorado. The latest thing going on in Colorado, of course, they legalized cannabis, and there's been big lineups purchasing it. But long before that happened, well, several weeks before that happened, they also made available one of the other cannabinoids called cannabidiol, It's close cousin to THC or tetrahydrocannabinol, but it's different from it. And it happens to have unique and powerful anti-seizure, anti-epilepsy qualities. And there was actually a piece on CBC Radio describing, with a neurologist from Colorado, describing the effectiveness of this substance in suppressing seizures in people who had had every known patented drug for epilepsy and not been successfully treated. But one young girl in particular, who was having pretty much a seizure every day, went from a seizure every day, which is 30 a month, down to 3 a month, and was able to go back to school and start riding her bike and, you know, join the other kids and enjoy life.
So there are uses. Yeah, there are many, many uses. I'm sure Diana will enlighten us further on some of the things that have been clinically proven, or, well, clinically shown, demonstrated, the uses of...
I think it's important to also recognize that cannabis is a plant like many other plants. A lot of remedies in medicine have been derived from plant sources over the years. In fact, they probably have supplied the majority of remedies that we use even today, either the plant remedy itself or a derivative. And I don't think we should think of cannabis as a special or unique plant. It's an unusual plant. It has very unusual properties. But were we to, for example, make it freely accessible for medical purposes, I think we'd discover that it has strengths and weaknesses like everything else, and we'd stop getting so excited about it and just treat it in the normal way we treat so many
exactly,
other things.
Exactly, exactly. It's interesting. That's why the history of what happened to it, that's one side of it, the medical uses, etc. And then there's this whole question of hemp. You mentioned clothing and... paper, mm-hmm. You can make food, apparently. They can even make lumber out of it because of that long fiber. The uses apparently are just endless, list, what we could... And, of course, one of the things that interested many people is, we could maybe save our forests if we were growing this stuff, and we've got so much land in Canada.
Hemp also grows on marginal land, much better than many other kinds of trees that we now use for things like paper and other purposes. And as a result, we could probably use hemp to grow, to fill in areas of marginal land that have been either deforested and lost some of their soil, or simply are of poor quality soils in the first place.
Yeah,
I want to add one other thing about safety.
Yeah,
and that's to do with the cancer risk, because much of the use of cannabis is still in the form of smoking a joint of some sort. The comparison would be to tobacco. Now, tobacco, of course, mostly is smoked. Some people chew it and use it in other ways, but it's mostly smoked as well. Cancer-causing substances in both cannabis and tobacco smoke are in roughly equivalent quantities. So there are carcinogens in both cannabis smoke and tobacco smoke. But there's a fundamental difference that's got nothing to do with the cancer-causing substances. It's to do with substances that actually cause cancer to regress. In other words, anti-cancer substances. And cannabis, actually, some of the cannabinoids are quite potent in respect of their anti-cancer properties. And a recent study, I was at a conference at UBC on cannabis research several months ago, and one of the speakers had particularly involved himself with a long-term study of carcinogenic potential from cannabis smoke. And in fact, the outcome of the study was that baseline cancer rates were not affected by cannabis smoke, whereas they were dramatically increased by tobacco smoke. So the fear that the carcinogens in cannabis smoke will increase cancer rates appears to be unfounded.
Another interesting point. Well, do you think there's a chance that, one, Canada will move to decriminalize cannabis in the next 5 years or 10 years? What do you think?
Well, I think that it could happen, and I think it would be rational. It would be sensible if it did, but I'm not sure if it will. And I'll tell you why I think it's sensible. Right now in the United States, there are more people in jail because of drug-related offenses, and of those, the vast majority are in jail because of cannabis-related offenses. So if you consider that housing somebody in a jail, which is of questionable value with respect to rehabilitation, if you realize that every time you do that, you have to pay money to keep that person in jail, and I am certainly absolutely not in favor of privately owned jails. I think they are responsibility for the public. But at any rate, that's another issue.
Yeah.
But with respect to just the sheer cost of managing literally tens of thousands of people in jail, and in this country there are not so many, but there are still people who end up in jail. I think if we made it legal, the advantage would be we could do several things. First of all, we could talk about the health effects in their broadest sense, and that would include discussion of the adverse effects of marijuana, of cannabis and ingested or inhaled marijuana. We would be able to talk about them sensibly. We wouldn't have to exaggerate and make up sort of fantasy stories about it. It would be down to earth, and we would be talking about it on a more even footing. The way we talk about the problems with alcohol, we talk about them openly and freely because alcohol is legal. When something is illegal, then you have a damper put on public discussion about it.
Okay, thank you for that. Listen, I'm going to tonight refer to my, the trouble is I have to turn to, so my glasses, I can see the screen here, but I got an email asking, is it better to smoke or ingest medical marijuana? What's the best way to...
Well, it's, I don't know if it's better, one or better or worse, it's just different. When you inhale anything into your lungs, the surface area of your lung is about the size of a tennis court. It's a huge surface area, and that's because of the way the lung is constructed. So what you have at that point is a huge surface area to which the inhaled substance is immediately in contact. And consequently, you get a very rapid increase in serum level. And of course, if you're ingesting it or inhaling it, rather, with respect to tetrahydrocannabinol or THC, then you get a powerful effect on your brain. But if you inhale one of the other substances, you get a rapid onset of effect from one of the other cannabinoids or terpenoids as well. It is also irritating for the lungs. It isn't carcinogenic, as I pointed out earlier, but it is irritating, and some people just don't like that irritation. People already have problems with their lungs. That's very, very unhealthy for them to inhale any kind of smoke. So basically, you can see that that's the primary effect you get with rapid absorption and rapid onset with in large amounts when you inhale it. When you ingest it, you get a much slower absorption. Absorption in the past has been somewhat unreliable at times, but now people understand a little bit better that you have to include it with some kind of dietary fat in which it is dissolved, and therefore it is more evenly absorbed. So there are ways to get around that absorption problem, but it's slower, more gentle, milder in effect. So there's really more a difference than there is an advantage of one or the other. Each of them has their own special features that make them just different.
I think we'll, when I have Diana on, we'll probably deal with that subject. One of the other questions he asked is age a factor in the use of marijuana?
Given that it's relatively safe and has been used, for example, for the nausea caused by cancer chemotherapy, which, as you probably, or listeners probably know, cancer tends to affect older people in general. There are some childhood cancers, but most cancers affect older people. And there's never been a problem with older people using it. I think the primary safety element is the fact that it doesn't affect the brainstem. Mm. And many other substances do and make you sedated or dizzy or otherwise affect your cognitive functioning. Marijuana doesn't appear to have that direct effect.
Again, I'd love to do a whole program just on the differences between marijuana and alcohol. Some of which are covered in this book. Mm. But he has one more question, and it is it addictive? And we sort of covered this earlier, and I think I know what the answer is, but please, is it addictive?
Almost any substance can be can create dependency. Dependency is a more clear-cut term because it means you depend on it. You can't get away from it. Now, if you have, let me give you an example. If you have severe pain somewhere in your body, and you take something, a painkiller of some sort, and it relieves the pain while you take it, then as soon as you stop taking it, the pain comes back. And so you take it again. And you are, as long as you have severe pain, you could say you're dependent on that substance, that painkiller. The difference occurs when you want something or require something, not for the purpose that it was intended. In other words, if you take cannabis for nausea associated with cancer chemotherapy, but once the cancer chemotherapy is over, you kind of like the buzz you get from it and you decide to continue using it. It's presumably a form that is rich in THC, which has an anti-nauseant effect. And you start to use it not because you actually have a condition that it relieves, but because you just really like the feeling. And you go on using it, and when somebody points it out that you're getting into difficulty like that RCMP officer did recently, you go on using it anyway.
But let's make a comparison between, let's say, alcohol and,
sure.
and cannabis.
Yes.
Alcohol seems to be an addiction now. It's a sickness, we understand. But
and all dependencies that are out of control and are not directly related to function. And for the listener that asked this question, maybe I could put it in the form of one simple question that anyone can ask themselves. If you are using a substance, whatever it may be, whether it's alcohol or painkillers or cannabis or just medication you got from your doctor for some other purpose, if it increases your functional capacity, the Canadian Society for Addiction Medicine tends to say you're not pathologically addicted. In other words, the use of it is, or the dependency on it, is not a sign of a separate addictive problem. That means that you could, for example, use, let me give an example that's maybe more associated with addiction, something like morphine. You could use morphine for 15 years because you have a very chronic and unpleasant pain that is only relieved when you take the morphine. You're not addicted to the morphine. You're addicted to not feeling that horrible pain. If one day you have surgery and that horrible pain goes away and you stop using the morphine because you don't need it anymore, then you know that you had been using it all along correctly, because you could only function when you had the pain by using the morphine. Once the morphine wasn't needed anymore, you simply stopped using it. Now, you might have a minor physiological dependency, which is part and parcel of many drugs that we administer, not just narcotics or cannabis or others, but heart drugs, for example. We have to stop them slowly too.
Which really nicely segues into my next topic, which is it's called the Drug Assessment Working Group, or sometimes referred to as the Therapeutics Initiative. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the TI evidence-based drug therapy, Warren.
Absolutely. It's a subject dear to my heart because it has been for just over 20 years now a source of probably the most accurate information about medicinal drugs, pharmaceutical agents that has actually existed on planet Earth. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm actually quoting experts in drug assessment around the world who have recognized the Therapeutics Initiative, which is based at UBC, as one of the most helpful and informative sources of information about the actual effects of medication. A lot of information in the public domain is advertising when it comes to drugs, and it's usually biased, and biased in some very characteristic ways. It exaggerates the benefits, and it diminishes the adverse effects or obscures them. The Therapeutics Initiative has, for 20 years, taken all the studies on a particular drug, looked at them in exquisite detail, and come up with a far more accurate assessment of what a particular drug would do. And let me give you one example, Vioxx. Yep. Vioxx was used by hundreds of thousands of people around the world, but in BC, the support in the form of government subsidization was withheld on the basis of what the Therapeutics Initiative said. And when the roof came crashing in on Vioxx, and it turned out that at least 100,000 people had had serious heart attacks or other cardiac events because of this drug, people in BC had avoided that particular problem almost completely because only of the Therapeutics Initiative. Unfortunately, the provincial government didn't like that.
Well, I think it was more the pharmaceutical industry through their proxy, the provincial government.
Yeah, it's hard to tell where Tweedledum and Tweedledee were separated from one another. What the government did, on the instructions of the pharmaceutical industry, of course, they would never admit such a nefarious connection, but in fact, the link was clearly very close, they established a group called the Pharmaceutical Task Force,
yeah.
a little body that was supposed to assess the TI, the Therapeutics Initiative, and tell whether it was any good. Everybody knew it was good, but the industry hated it with a passion and still does. And so they persuaded the government to set up this Pharmaceutical Task Force and to stack it with people who had close ties to the pharmaceutical industry. There were 9 members. Well, you divide 9 by 2, you get 4.5. You can't chop people in half. So 5 members of the group happened to be closely linked to the pharmaceutical industry.
Didn't Canada, British Columbia, get a lot of flack? I saw some stuff coming from Europe, all over the world,
yes,
about what they did.
Yeah. What the Pharmaceutical Task Force did was basically advocated destroying the Therapeutic Initiative. They said it was a closed group. It didn't get information from enough people, like the pharmaceutical industry, of course, which has lots and lots of information it was dying to share with the drug regulators in BC. And so they recommended that, and the government tried its best to make it happen, but they got negative feedback. They got kickback from all over the English-speaking, and even countries like Germany and some of the South American countries. There was input saying, we read the Therapeutic Initiative in translation, and it is the best source of drug information you can get, bar none. And as a result, the government hedged, and then they did a neat trick. And we're not quite sure what exactly happened, but about a year and a half ago, they suspended all the funding for the Therapeutics Initiative. They took all the money away, saying that some of the research projects were using drug information from the province inappropriately.
Yes, and we all heard about that.
We all heard about that.
What did they call it? It was,
It was a terrible gesture. They wouldn't explain what had gone on. They just said, we're taking your money away because of the drug information about individuals using...
Confidentiality had been
Well, it breached. Turned out what the real problem was, that the government system was flawed.
Oh.
So they never actually said that in public. In fact, they threatened to call in the RCMP, but they never did. They threatened to fire people, but they didn't. They just took their money away, which amounted to the same thing. And then they waited, and they waited, and they waited, and everybody waited. There were articles all over the place saying, when are they going to do something? They said they're going to do something, and never did. Anyway, the bottom line was, at the end, it turned out that it was the government's way of handling confidential data that was at fault. The Therapeutics Initiative have never done anything that wasn't fully acceptable to the government at that time, and in fact, there's no evidence of any significant breach of confidentiality at all.
No, and I'm really happy to see. I went to the website tonight just to have a look. I was informed about the TI a long time ago by another doctor friend in Vancouver, and he alluded to Vioxx, and at the time, I think. The media, who likes to dramatize this kind of, actually said that they probably, they had a number of people, they probably saved lives of a certain number of people
yep.
because of the research they had done.
That's
and
right.
the alarms went off and they said, wait a minute.
They saved lives and they saved money. Our governments are always talking, and especially at the federal level, they're all talking about saving money. You know, it's run more efficiently, run the economy better. Well, something like the TI was a perfect example of something that saved money and also saved lives.
Yeah.
And the idea that you would try and destroy it, to me, is incomprehensible, unless, of course, you've got a nice, cozy arrangement somewhere that nobody knows about.
Yeah, they call it also the Drug Assessment Working Group, and they apparently contributes to the Federal Drug Review, the
yes.
CDR.
Yeah.
And the federal government seems to like it because that information that they get is very valuable, just as you said.
Well, they like it, but they didn't stand up for it.
No.
And that's the problem. And I think now the funding has been restored to the Therapeutics Initiative, but it has been marginalized. It used to be the primary advisor of the government of BC for what it would do with drugs. The government was free to do what it would with the advice, but at least it accepted the advice, and now there are some barriers imposed between the TI and the government that make it much less part of what's going on in this province.
I've just got to check this. There's another email concerning ingesting it, and it's crucial to realize, I'll just read it, how potent to eat cannabis is. Please warn this to Dr. Bell off air. Well, we'll do that off air. So apparently now you, the public, have you've heard it, but be careful when you ingest cannabis. Apparently it can be more potent.
potency is purely a function of amount.
Yeah.
And with any substance, cannabis or your favorite heart medicine, whatever you happen to be taking or not taking, all substances, there's a saying in toxicology, the dose makes the poison.
Yeah. You're listening to CKVS 93.7, Voice of the Shuswap, the core of the matter. It's been a very interesting meeting for me tonight, interviewing Warren Bell. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me.